to the old me, scared and unseen. You're the reason I built this dream. Now I speak so others thrive. Turn my scars into sound. I come alive from the ashes of the breakdown. I don't run, I rise, won't back down. This is keep it real, keep it purpose bound. Every word a step, every truth profound. We don't heal in silence, we fight with grace, softness and defiance, lighting up this place.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Edna White, and you are on Wounded to Wonderful. Thank you for being here. We're so excited that you're here today, and I'm excited to be here, as you can tell, right? So I just want to introduce our guest today that we're so honored to have, and I think she's on a different time zone because she's really given us some good stuff, because she said 9 o'clock. So I'm thinking of the other side of the world when it's like really 4 over here, even though it looks like 9. But I would like to introduce none other than Victoria Wilson Crane from the UK, right?
Yes.
Yeah. UK. Yes. I'm so glad you're here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to
be here. Great. She's an author and a speaker. So how do you show up in the world as an author and a speaker over there in the UK?
Yeah, thank you. So as an author, I've written a book recently, which is called 16 Days. And really it was, it started as part of just a writing exercise because my niece, who was only 22, died quite suddenly and unexpectedly. And writing was a really good way that I could start to process what had happened, really, and get things out of my system. And quite soon after starting to write, I realized that maybe people might be interested in hearing the story. So it formed into a short book. So I now have, my book has been out there since January this year, and I've had some really, really pleasant feedback and really welcome feedback from people saying it's actually helping them understand how to be in what can be a strange situation where you are very close to the person that's died, but you're also maybe supporting other people who in your eyes are actually closer to the, what I would say, the epicenter of grief than perhaps you are. So right. I had my niece's parents, and she had 4 parents, she had 2 brothers, grandparents. And I had this perception that if you kind of picture an archery target or a dartboard, I wasn't completely at the center, but I was somewhere in one of those kind of outer rings of grief. And I found that a useful way to help me understand my position as being both the supporter and the supported.
Okay. So how would you, if you're talking about that ring, that the bullseye ring, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know how we always talk about the steps of grief, you know, with all the steps. Is on that bullseye, because I like that concept. On that bullseye, is any of that there? Or how can you make it, you know, can you put it a little plainer so that we can like really see?
Definitely. Do you mean the stages of grief that were talked about by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross? Yeah, I'd actually challenge that. I from what I understand, the work that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did was more based around people's acceptance of a terminal diagnosis rather than grief.
Okay.
And my understanding is that over time that was a little bit bent out of shape and was taken to be about grief. And then this kind of understanding that people grieve in a very linear fashion.
Right.
And maybe your listeners, and I would certainly challenge that, that I don't think grief is linear.
Yeah, no, neither do I. That's why I asked, because I, when my brother passed away, I was angry. I wasn't sad. And I really was so connected to him that I knew he passed away and I wasn't even near him. Mm-hmm. I just knew it. So I was mad. I was more angry. And I was like, wait a minute, am I doing it wrong? Because, you know, you go to those classes and that, you know, and what you were just talking about, that's how they teach you. It's like, okay, you have this steps, this is how it goes. And I'm like, I am way down to number five already. Like, what? How do I even get to five? But like you said, it's really everybody's experiences it differently. But you're still all of us, right? We all experience it, those emotions, but it could be different.
I think all those stages are all really valid, but I would challenge that people experience them in a linear fashion and certainly experience them in the same linear fashion. Because for me, grief has been much more messy. And even on a given day,
it's really messy. I like that.
And all those things. Like So I actually think, as much as I really value Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work, I think it has been a little bit taken out of context, which essentially has put people under quite a lot of pressure to be grieving in a certain way. And my understanding is that grief is much more personal, and we should never feel under that pressure of, well, what stage are you at today, or where are you feeling today?
It's true. Yeah, I like you're saying grief is messy. Mm. It is messy. and it's all valid. That's important to say. Grief is messy and it's all valid. Yeah. How in your work around your niece and writing this book, can you share with us the expressions of loss? Like, how can you share the most important parts of your book with us about loss?
Yeah, certainly. I think the subtitle of the book is A Sudden Death, What to Say. And I think one of the most abiding memories is that people generally said to me, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. And I've certainly felt in that situation when I've been facing people who've experienced a death. I've been in that situation when I've had colleagues that have told me news that I've thought, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to do. And you desperately don't want to do the wrong thing.
Yeah, you don't want to say the wrong thing.
Exactly, you don't say the wrong thing. But actually, some of the things I've come to learn are that what's been most helpful to me is when at least someone says something and tries and makes an effort, because what can feel most hurtful, and it's never intended to be hurtful, but what can feel most hurtful is when people just ignore what has happened, when this thing of a complete massive magnitude has happened to you, and if somebody just doesn't mention it or glosses over it or And all from their kind of experience of, I really don't know what to say for the best, but it's certainly
The best. It really is the best. And a quick hug or a handshake, however it goes, you know, it's really
I know. Really good. I've got a work colleague who just regularly texts me and just says, how are you? And I know exactly what that question means. And it's not, how's work going today? Or it's not, how's that project going? It's how feeling because of Mary Lou, because she's not here anymore. And that's really, really helpful. So I think one of the really strong messages in my writing and in my work has been around helping people to know or to feel a bit more comfortable about what to say and what to do.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think there's universal truths. I don't think that everything works for everybody, but there are some things that I think are probably quite gentle that any of your listeners could do. One of the things I quite often now say is, would you like to tell me a little bit about what happened?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of opens the door.
Yeah, it opens the door.
Isn't crying. That isn't saying, tell me everything that happened. That isn't, I want to know your everything in every secrets.
Yeah, right. Or what happened? You know, like what happened? It's nicer to say, would you like to share what happened? Yeah. Would you like to tell me a little bit about what happened? That's much better than, hey, what happened?
Exactly. Because your inner mind wants to say, what on earth went on there then?
Yeah, exactly. It really does.
So that can be quite helpful. And also, I think my other stock phrase is, pick your time of day, but how are you this morning? How are you this
morning?
Or how are you now? It's the question of how are you?
Yeah, it's so inviting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So inviting. It's so inviting, especially around loss, you know, especially around loss. One thing when I lost my brother, this is how it felt for me. And I keep this in mind when I'm talking to anybody. It felt like a piece of my world. So like, you know how there's all the planets are aligned and all that. It felt like that. It felt like one of the planets had just blew up and was missing. So whether they provided shade or sun, it wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And that is so, it was like, wow, this whole entity is not here. Mm-hmm. And now I don't have this entity. And now it affects my personal life and more so my work life. You know, we tend to say, maybe you can give light with this. We tend to say we wear these hats, you know, so when we go to work, we're not the same person as we are personally at home. How does loss affect your workplace setting, you know?
Mm-hmm. Really interesting question. My niece actually worked with us. She was a student when she died, and she helped our team just in the holidays. She did a little bit of admin work and stuff like that.
Right.
So there's actually a strange chapter in the book which talks about my communication of what had happened, and one of the bits of communication is around telling my work colleagues, which possibly sounds a little bit odd. Why would you go out of your way to tell your colleagues that your niece has died? Mm-hmm. But actually, she was their work colleague. She was someone who, she probably spent more time with some of them than I spent with them over the last year. And it was really important. And at the time, it was early 2020 when Mary Lou died, and it was just before COVID. And as a team, though, we weren't all co-located, so we were very used to using Skype or Zoom to meet. And it was suggested that I might get the team together on Zoom. And I just said, actually, I'm not far from the team. Perhaps I'll just get them together in person. And I'm relieved that I did that. I've never actually asked them what their reaction was to that. But it was such a relief to be able to tell them myself, because I think one of the challenges is when you see people for the first time after something like that, and people don't know what to say. At least I kind of done that, and I'd done that for myself, so I'd have that opportunity. And as I say, I'm curious actually, and I might ask them what their reaction was to that, because for me that was important, and for me that was helpful. I'm not sure how helpful that was for them, but it was useful for me. Because actually, it meant that from a work point of view, at least my immediate colleagues knew about it, And then a very nice thing that my company did when the book was released earlier on this year, they bought a number of copies and they said, would you like to give them to members of staff? So I said, well, why don't we use it as an opportunity to ask our staff what they would find helpful for staff who are grieving? And we ended up having, I think we had over 80 responses from staff who gave suggestions. Wow. As to what could be helpful. And some of them were some of the things you might expect, and some of the things were a little bit unusual.
That's really good. Really good. Yeah. Really good.
That was really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about not knowing what to say, and communication is affected when you have loss. and you know, any type of loss, but those unexpected losses, you seem to have more, you know, less to say because you don't, you're still taken aback by it as well. And I like what you said about, you know, you were able to go in and say something about it to your coworkers. But how is it, how can you get around, or how can you, navigate being able to communicate during loss?
Very difficult. I think from my point of view, and I can only really speak from my experience, it was it was talking about it. And I think because we're from quite a close family and quite a small family, but with quite a lot of friends in the local community. And one of the things I did quite early on was support my mum, who had to tell her friends that her granddaughter had died. Mm-hmm. And I think in the telling and the retelling and the explaining and the describing and talking to different people, it was one way that it helped make it feel real. In the very, very, very early days of what happened. But I actually think that's kind of extrapolated to even talking to you now, because I still need to tell that story. I still need to explain what's happened. I still need to tell people the impact that it's had upon me. So I think I would encourage people to, and we don't talk about death and dying, I don't think, in our times in the way that we ought to. We talk about other milestones in life with much greater ease than we do about death. And I just think
there's so much uncertainty around it.
Yeah, there is. And I think people think if we talk about it, we're going to make it happen, which
I
don't believe we have.
It's just like when you talk about money. Oh, if you talk about money and you know, you're going to make it, you're not going to have any, you know, because there's so much uncertainty around. And I think that's one of the mysteries that we have to, glean from with your loss, and my loss is gleaned from the fact of what they lived, because we can't bank on when they're on the other side. We don't know if there's another side. We don't know anything, but gleaning from the good portions of their life to kind of make loss feel like you said, real,
Yeah.
And I think at my brother's funeral, he died right after his graduation.
Goodness.
In a swimming accident. And he was at the graduation party, was supposed to go to the Marines the next day, signed up everything and he didn't make it. And I think I didn't know he had so many friends. Me and my brother were really close, but I didn't know they felt the way they felt about him. And when I say that when they came and told us this one, and I remember this guy so distinctly, he was a man that was like in the streets, he was a vagabond, and he would be walking around and he had this gruffy beard. He came into and he said, "I would like to say something." I said, "Sure," And he went up and he said, "I want to thank," my brother was named Sylvester. He said, "I want to thank him. He always gave me his lunch. He would ride his bike to school and see me, and he would give me his lunch." And my mom would always say, "Why are you, when you come home, you're always eating up, making all these sandwiches and eating?" We never knew. Day of his high school, time, 11th and 12th grade, he saw this man and gave him his lunch. Every day. And I think that made me so much more proud of him. And I was able to really, it almost created a silhouette of him that I could just really grab and say, that was my last hug, it gave me peace. And I was able to, because I was angry for a long while with everybody. I was mad with everybody. That's my best bud. I'm mad with everyone. And I was even mad with myself, and I could have stopped him and had all these things going through me. But I think holding on to those magnificent pieces gives you another chance to just to keep hugging and hugging them and give them, you know, and making them more part of your life, the living part. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. I think if any of your listeners are thinking about how they can support people who are grieving, we love it when people tell those stories.
Yeah.
Particularly when those stories are things that you've never heard before.
Right.
It's really cute and really, really nice. And it's a little bit sad because you think, oh, wait, I wish I'd known that at the time. But it can be really warm and comforting. Like you say, it can be like a hug when someone tells you you didn't know about this person who you thought you knew really well. If there's other sides to them that you'd never seen, that can be so nice. So I would urge your listeners to not hold those things back and to share them if you get the chance.
Yeah. And how did her loss impact you personally? Mm-hmm. And how did you kind of move it forward to kind of get to this place with this new book here?
Yeah. I mean, I think because I did feel like I was on that sort of slightly outer circle, I spent quite a lot of the very early days doing my best, whether it was effective or not, but doing my best to try and support those a bit closer.
Gotcha.
And it kind of occurred to me a couple of months later that I'm not really dealing with this very well, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of reading and a lot of research, and I found the grief recovery method, which is based on, it's the only evidence-based method that can help people through grief. It's been about 30 years.
Okay.
You can do it yourself, and there's a book, and you can take yourself through it, or you can work with a consultant who can kind of support you with that. And I did it myself, but then I did the training so I can help other people.
That's wonderful.
Which has been really helpful. And listening to other people's stories kind of puts your situation in perspective sometimes and helps you reflect where you are. So I think the kind of typical academic that I am, I wanted to learn lots about it, and I wanted to learn about myself and learn what was out there. And that's what drove me, I think, to looking for grief recovery. I think in the sense of recovery, some people have a bit of a struggle with that word, because what we're not saying is, okay, so you're fixed then, and suddenly everything is better.
Right, you know, yeah.
All I can
recovery is ongoing, right? It's ongoing.
Yeah, all I kind of promise is that you'll feel better than you did before.
Yeah.
Kind of work.
Yeah.
And that helped me, and I certainly feel better than I did. I'm not sure I'll ever be the same again.
Absolutely not. It's going to be different. It's like I said, it's your world. You got a kingdom. You know, we are all kingdoms, and we have worlds within us. And all of a sudden, the world is missing out of the world that you know. It's devastating. It's devastating. Yeah. Could you imagine missing part of the U.S. or part of the U.K.?
It's just gone.
That's tragic. That is really tragic.
Yeah, and I think with a young loss as well, there's quite a lot of a loss of hopes and dreams, because I kind of fancied that she might support me in my old age, or you know, she might be around to, and that's all gone as well. Those sort of images of where she might have taken her life, it's gone. And maybe that's a bit the same with your brother, that it's just that the loss of what you, it's not just the loss of what you had, it's the loss of what was still to come.
Yeah, it's still to come. Exactly. The loss, that's the part. It's, I had those memories and I had those stories that people told me what he did that I didn't know parts of. And I kind of put that together. But what was really missing was, now he can't be an uncle to his three nephew nieces. Now he can't be an uncle to my sister's children. Now I can't see him walk up the aisle and get married. Now he can't be part of my wedding. Now he can't be part of anybody's, you know, now I'm thinking about that. Now I won't see him in the Marines, you know, graduating from this level to that level. So yeah, it's the loss of the dreams, the hopes and dreams.
Definitely.
It really is. You're making it so very clear. And I know that Wounded to Wonderful's audience is really, this is really something that we need to talk about. It's, and I like this, that loss, a death or a loss is is really the loss of all the hopes and dreams mm-hmm. that you had with that person. Yeah. That's really what it is. You made it so very clear for me, Victoria. Mm-hmm. It's very sure. clear. That was really good. I like that. Very clear. And I think that gives me a little bit more like that. It's like a load off, like, okay, now again, because I think about him all the time. And I kept saying, why am I not getting over this? There it is. The loss is of the hopes and dreams that he could be around for her, now his great niece and nephews, you know?
Yeah. That, yeah. And that's helped you understand your little world a little bit better then. That's really comforting, and maybe for your audience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what is it, one thing you could tell us, either from your book or from your experience with loss, or share with us, that would enrich us even more?
Yeah, I think it's just that underlying thing about talking about death and dying a little bit more. And try not be fearful of talking about it, because right. as I said, I don't think anyway in my belief system you can bring it on. I also mm-hmm. don't think necessarily stop it from happening.
Oh sure.
But we're all gonna face it, whether that's our own mortality or whether that's the mortality mm-hmm. of the important people that are around us. So I would just encourage people to start to try and engage with it and what that means. It can be so helpful if people have discussed their final wishes,
right?
Discuss what they would like to happen. It was certainly helpful and surprising to us that my niece of only 22 years had discussed what her funeral might be like. It was great that she'd badgered us into being organ donors, because at the time in the UK, you had to opt in. It's actually an opt-out system now. But you had mm-hmm. to at that time, and it was very reassuring to know her wishes around that. So again, if you can have any of those conversations with your loved ones, it does make this kind of situation slightly easier. I wouldn't say easier, because it's very difficult, but it does mm-hmm. just slightly if you know some of those things. Because one thing I didn't understand until having been part of organising a funeral, you've got an awful lot of decisions to make in quite a short period of time, mm-hmm. at a time when your head is not really in the right frame of mind to be making decisions. So if you know some of that stuff ahead of time, that can really, really help. And I think it's not morbid, it's not going to bring it on, but it's is not those that are left behind.
I know that when I guess my brother didn't even realize it, but we always talked about that, you know. We always talked about how he wanted, what he wanted his funeral to look like, what he wanted to be wearing, you know. And he always was a sneaker guy. He was like, give me a tuxedo with Adidas sneakers on, you know, something like that. You know, he made a joke of it. And, you know, and he said, you know, he always liked his hair cut short. And he says, I don't want a lot of going on and carrying on. I don't want all of that. He said, I just want to, you know, good people saying, you know, good things about me. And then he said, because I'm already gone, I'm out of there, you know. And this is, he's like, I'm out of there, I got, you know, I just need a crown, you know, and all these people talking about me, just push my crown on, I can go like flea fry, you know. So he says, tell me, I can go flying. He's like, and he used to have this gold necklace with a cross on it, and he gave it to me actually. And he says, this I won't need this, because I'll have my name will have like all these, like his name, he used to call himself Sly, so he have his name in all gold. He said it'll be all gold, real rubies. That's what he said, be real rubies.
Real rubies.
So, you know, he used to always say those things, and we used to crack up laughing, you know. And you know, and I was like, you don't want a horse, you know, a horse and carriage? He's like, nah. He's like, nah, I don't like these streets over here. I just rather just like, you know, something nice and simple. And then he's like, you know, and then just put me out into the water. Just let me float on out into the water. And I was like, wow. I was like, okay. And we did just that. So it was wonderful, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I kind of got to my senses after the, you know, and I was like, he told me what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And Melissa said, I told you? I was like, yeah. And so she did exactly what he wished, and you know, and he was also an organ donor as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, that can be such a such a relief and a
oh yeah
a really kind thing to do. And that's really good.
Yeah, and I always look around, like I'm a voyeurist, but a nice one, not one peeping, no peeping Tom, but I like to sit in the park and just see people going by. And I remember sitting after maybe about 2 months after he passed away, and because they had taken, I think they took his liver, some other part. I know they contacted about the liver or something and contacted my mom. So I was looking around, I wonder who has his liver. I wonder, you know, and everybody that was smiling at me, oh, that person's, you know, I would make myself, that person's got my brother's liver, you know. And then I would see people that resembled him. I was like, I wonder if he's got it, you know, and I would always like just sit there and like crack up laughing at myself, of course, and just imagine those things. But that kind of made my, now looking at it, made my, the dreams kind of come like fruition for me on my side. Like, I know somebody has his organs, you know, and somebody is walking down the aisle with their great niece or great nephew or me, you know, and they're at the wedding or they're, you know, at the party, you know, they're alive. And that kind of made me feel good about that.
Yeah, you know? Good. That's really comforting, really comforting.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. So, Victoria, we really thank you for being on our show. I'm sure we're going to have you back because we really want you to read some of this and get some real, you know, questions from the audience. But we're going to do something on loss together, and you will be back for our audience in the very near future. But right now, this is the end of the show. How can my audience find you, ask you a couple of questions, buy your book, and stay connected with you?
Sure, I'd love to hear from anybody and everybody who wishes to talk about this. As I say, I don't think we talk about this enough. So you can quite easily find me on LinkedIn with the name Victoria Wilson Crane. It's not that common, so you can find me on there. The book's available on Amazon, so you'll easily find it on there. And it's both in hard copy and in an ebook format. And if you've got show notes or something, I can share my website with you. It's drvictoriawilsoncrane.co.uk. You can find all links to my book, both my grief work and the book there.
Wonderful. And audience, we will have the all of her information on the bottom of this video for you to take a look at. It'll be available in the credits available for you in that. So we really thank you, Victoria, for being our guest today. And audience, please look for her book, 16 Days. This is Edna White and my esteemed guest, Victoria Wilson Crane. We're saying goodbye for now.
Thank you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.